You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Here we are, episode 30.
Welcome, Blake.
Thank you, Nick. How are you feeling? There's some amazing things about to happen this week.
An amazing thing. Yeah, the kids are going back to school.
They are.
Yeah.
How do you, well, firstly, it's not about you. How do the kids feel about heading back into the school year? They've had the strangest of years last year. Yep. And
they can't wait. Kids, primary school kids, just want to see friends. They just want to socialise. That's what they see school as.
Yeah.
With a little bit of education on the side, but really it's just about school, sport, activities, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Miller's the same. He's chomping at the bit to get back and get amongst it.
Yep.
He was absolutely of the opinion that he was doing more school work at home during homeschooling than at school. So looking forward to going back to school for a break, I think. what are you going to do? Because you had the three kids,
yep.
Work, homeschooling, doing a bit of podcasting on the side. What are you going to do with all your spare time?
Well, I suppose I can probably do more work more quickly.
Yes.
So probably become very efficient at that. Mm. It'd just be good to have a video call without someone popping up behind me in some sort of costume.
Dolly Parton, Pharaoh.
Or crawling on the floor next to me, tugging at my leg, saying, can I have this packet of whatever?
Yeah. But where's the entertainment value going to come from?
That's true. It'll just be the cat and the dog.
Yeah. I think you'll be lonely.
I'll just come and hang out here.
Done. Sounds like a plan. All right. We have got this week, we have an amazing guest. Who are we talking to?
Today's guest is Njaldul Nguyen, who is is described by other people as a community advocate, not as she describes herself, but she's a lawyer by trade and she grew up in some really tough conditions. In fact, that's not even a good way to describe it. She grew up in really tough conditions in a refugee camp, displaced multiple times through various countries. Found her way to Australia, and look, you've really just got to hear this story for yourself. It's a story of grit, determination, and self-discovery. Here's Njaldul. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing, and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe, and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hi, Njaldul. Welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
How are you, Nick?
I'm good, thanks, Blake. How are you? To complete the triangle.
I am fantastic. What a beautiful day. What a beautiful January day.
Yeah, contrast to yesterday.
Sun is shining. Njaldul, you've had a break over Christmas. What did you get up to?
A lot of family reunions. I think the lockdown really made people appreciate how much they... as often as they find their family annoying, how much they actually like them. So it was really good to hang around with a lot of my family members. I went for catch-ups, you know, lunches and dinners, and also met a lot of my friends that I had not seen through the year. So it was really good. It was busy, but it was good.
Yeah, it has been a great opportunity to do that. I think for all of us being in lockdown, we really have appreciated the things that matter the most, and that is catching up with friends and family. You got a big family?
Yes, I do. I have 6 younger siblings and an older sister. And then I have extended family members, so cousins, aunts. And also culturally, when you've lived a long time with somebody or even just shared, you know, certain experiences, like say living in a refugee camp, you just consider them your family as well. So I think we have a very extended notion of what a close family is. So that was also good. So for example, one of the things I did was going for a lunch with one of my aunts, and it was a really good reunion, and she always hosts a Christmas lunch and cooks for everybody, and there's a dance where the kids get to dance. It's fun. So it was good.
Nice. Look forward to hearing more about your extended family. Hey, we like to ask our guests on the Dolanders, what do you do?
Well, in the main, until quite recently, I was a lawyer.
Yeah.
But I also do other things. I've written a couple of stuff, or more than a couple of stuff, actually. So maybe I am a writer in that sense. Yeah. And accidentally found myself now being referred to as a community advocate as a result of, I think, some of the media commentary that I've been engaging over the last few years. So,
Do you refer to yourself as a community advocate? What would you call it?
I don't know, and I'm not sure if I see myself as that, actually. There's just a lot of, I think, labels that I'm not really entirely 100% comfortable with, but I haven't also found the right frame for it. So I am leaving them there, partly because they communicate something that I think is right, but I'm not sure if they're accurate.
Okay.
It for me. So, and there's a really interesting saying by an African-American, legendary African-American opera singer that sort of, I mean, to paraphrase, that the only people that like pigeon souls are pigeons. So I find labels sometimes to be interesting pigeonholes, and I'm not a pigeon, I think.
No, you're definitely not a pigeon.
Yeah.
Confirmation. Yeah.
Okay, we will not, we won't label it then. But suffice to say, you are one very, very busy woman. Plus, you've got a couple of kids.
Yes, yes, I think that's my most important role, being a mom. I think I've been busy. Until recently, I thought that was okay, but I'm trying to redefine what busyness means now. Maybe we'll get into that later.
Yeah, I think we should. I reckon everyone's had a bit of a look at, you know, the amount of time that they've got in their life and starting to choose what really is the most important thing in terms of what you do with your own personal time, and look forward to hearing how you have reflected on that. On the Dolanders, what we like to do is basically go back to the start and talk to our guests about where they were born and where they grew up. Could you share with us where you were born and perhaps where you grew up?
Yeah, I was born in a refugee camp called Itang in Ethiopia. And I was born there because by the time of my birth, there was a civil war ongoing in Sudan before it became two countries. And essentially the civil war was to create two countries, with one in the north and one in the south. And that war started in 1983, and that would have been the second civil war. And so as a result, I was born in a refugee camp in Itang. And about 1991, I was born in 87, about 1991, there was another civil war in Ethiopia. Now, this civil war was not connected to what was going on in South Sudan. It was just civil strife within Ethiopia. And as a result, my family and I got displaced back to Sudan. And, you know, mom talks about walking by foot for around 40 days. Being chased on the ground by armed forces and bombarded, aerial bombardment by the Air Force of Sudan. And, you know, I recall images of people, long lines of people walking, a lot of cattle, people carrying their, you know, all they had on the back or their heads. I don't recall faces very well. I don't recall much of the journey except snippets, really. And then so we got to Sudan, and I'm not sure what happened, but I ended up in a second refugee camp in Kenya called Kakuma with stepmoms.
Mm-hmm.
I went there with one stepmom and lived there with another stepmom. And then I was in and out of that refugee camp for most of my life until I came to Australia in 2005. So yeah. I started my primary school there.
And you were separated from your mum?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Do you know how that happened? Or it was?
I really don't. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've got to ask mum more details about it. But, I mean, when we've touched on it, she said my dad wanted us to be in Kenya, maybe because it was safer at that time. There's no war going on in Kenya. So she remained behind, and I came with my stepmother, and I started primary school in Kakuma, and then got out of the camp, went to Nairobi for a while, lived with another stepmom, and that was it was a very traumatic childhood, and it was full of physical beatings and being denied food and being locked in rooms for days, you know, for mistakes, or sometimes really because you just pissed them off and you didn't know why. Mm.
By family members?
Or? By one of the stepmoms. Yeah. It's her, and then at some point, it's a very sad story in a way. Like, at some point she couldn't even be bothered beating you up, so she asked either the watchman or some of the... There was a guy that my father had brought over to fix cars as a mechanic, and she'll get him to like just beat us up for her if she thought we had done mistakes. And so, I mean, I remember beatings that I was beaten so much, I just stopped crying, because at some point you literally lost your voice. You've been crying for hours, you lost your voice. Mm. So, and your voice being so coarse after for days. I remember being locked in rooms for a day or two without food. I remember being really hungry. So it was a very sad childhood, and I don't permit myself a lot to remember it. I actually don't. I think I, and for a long time, I think I found somewhere to put it so that I can go on with life, yeah. You know, yeah. and not be consumed with anger and bitterness and worthlessness. And I think maybe it was, I don't think I made that decision consciously. I don't think I conceptually thought, okay, I'm going to put it aside. But that's how it turned out. And I'm so glad it did, because I think there's a lot of people who rightfully break down as a result of, I think break down in a way they cannot put themselves together, yeah, as a result of such traumatic childhood. So, yeah.
Firstly, thank you for sharing that. I can't imagine, we can't imagine what that must have been like. So your father was actually a commander,
mm-hmm,
in the army, and you said you had a number of stepmoms, and you obviously you were separated from your mum, and all of those terrible things happened to you. I'm interested, as a kid, with all of those things going on and growing up in a refugee camp, how did you find moments of joy and moments of happiness, and what did those moments look like for you in that and throughout your childhood?
I think that's a good question. I think the beauty and the tragedy of life is that it exists both with its joys and its difficulties. And I don't, and maybe that's why we survive, because if it was just a consistent experience of tragedy, I don't think most of us would survive. Yeah. And I think even in those moments of being in that household where you knew every single moment of your existence in that space, you knew that you were constantly at risk of someone slapping you down, you know, I was lucky to go to a school and to have a teacher that was such a joy, and who, she was the first teacher that instilled a sense of worth and also a sense of like you are someone who can think and who can be something. And you know, she used to give me extra work. She used to encourage me to read and to write. And I have forgotten her name, but I have never forgotten how she made me feel, you know. So so that was a moment of joy. And I also was growing up at that household with a young stepbrother called Mashar, and who sort of took us up under his wings. And I remember these beautiful moments where he would, you know, he would get a Kenyan shilling and would go and buy a mango and would make sure each of us had a slice, you know, or you know, crack a sweet with his teeth and make sure that all of us picked a bit of it, you know. So, yeah, so those were very joyful moments. And I think being a kid also gave you its own sense of innocence that you could put those things aside and then go skip with your friends.
Yeah.
Even though that background still existed and even though you had to come back to it and try and survive again.
Let's stick with those joyous bits. Let's talk about your education and that teacher. And so when you think back to those times, and was there certain things that you learnt about that you gravitated towards? Like was there, like I think about, you know, when I was a kid in school and I was really interested early on in maths and didn't want to know about history and geography. And from your perspective, what was, from an educational perspective, what drew you in?
I don't recall much until maybe year five, year six, when I began recognizing that I was relatively okay in English, you know, writing. And I remember scoring a perfect score in one of my English test, and yeah, just thinking it's quite fascinating, as a language. But I was never, it just never really had very clear ideas where I was going. Maybe partly because there was not a lot of inspiration at the time, or maybe because I was just young, you know, I was an 8-year-old or 5-year-old in a refugee camp. But the older I got, I think the more I got interested in things like the notion of justice and human rights, and started debating, joining debates group and advocating in some ways through drama performances with a group called Youth and Culture in Kakuma, which is a group of young people that use drama and poems to tell stories about important issues like HIV/AIDS infection or domestic violence of women or human rights generally. So began getting attracted to those things at a very when I was 12 or 13, going on what? Yeah.
Okay. And you use some of that today, don't you?
Yeah, in some ways, yeah. I still use some of that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I have a sense of justice, and I want fairness. And I'm not sure to what extent. I mean, I'm careful not to associate everything in my life to experiences of childhood trauma. But I think that's part of it. That's part of never wanting others to feel powerless or be in a place of powerlessness. And until today, I have a very strong, and I know this is a strong word, but I have a very strong hate for people who wield, not hate for them, but hate for the use of power and position to bully, undermine, diminish other people by the mere fact that they are somehow in a place where you can do that. You know, I have a particular disgust for people who do that. And no matter sort of how powerful they are, I think it's one of the most, I don't know what's the word. I think it's a very shameful way to exist as a human being. If that's your talent, is robbing your talents of dignity and integrity. And it's and I think that definitely comes from a place of having felt powerlessness once, and knowing that it's a very unnecessary thing to impose on another human being. Yeah.
As a teenager, living through what you were living. Do you know? Do you remember what you hoped for?
I have to say, though, by the time I was a teenager, I was out of that household. I was living back in Kakuma. I had started high school and I had just met my mom after all those years of separation. So I had not just met her, I'd seen her once from when I was separated in the early 90s. I'd seen her once, I think, in around 1996, 97, when my father was killed in the war in South Sudan. And then I had not I started living with her in early 2000s. So I think, you know, by the time I was in my teenage years, a lot of the people that caused a lot of the pain early on were out of my life.
Yeah.
And things were much, much more different. You know, they weren't good, but they were very, very different. So, high school was very interesting. I think I was also beginning just to have a feeling of a sense of who I was and an emerging sense of that I can to some degree define my life, even though I was in a camp. And I began to really dream big. I wanted to be a lawyer one day, and I didn't think that was going to be possible. That's when I started doing a lot of beginning some form of the advocacy stuff around 13, 14. And by that time I was in high school in Kakuma.
Yeah. What, from a, you know, you talked about looking around and thinking, you know, you wouldn't mind being a lawyer. What was it that attracted you to that role, the law?
Yeah, I think a sense of justice, but also being surrounded by, in the camp, there's quite a few human rights lawyers and getting introduced to notions of justice and fairness and human rights and, you know, things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Like these very grand, and this is interesting as well, these very grand concepts about how we can reformulate the world. And then maybe they were so appealing to me as a refugee because I was a refugee and I existed in a camp that if it wasn't for international collaborations and international instruments like the human rights, you know, human rights laws or the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, I wouldn't have had the schooling I had, you know, because they provided the schooling. They provided the food rations every 14 days. They provided the water that, you know, the drinking water. So I began seeing the reality of this real big aspirational concepts about human rights and human beings being implemented in the life of refugees. And so I thought, that's interesting law. International human rights law is interesting and it's something I'd like to do. So that's where my interest started in. And around 2005, we got approval to resettle into Australia. So there's almost, I think there's about three ways if you're a refugee of leaving a refugee camp. I mean, the first is that luckily the war in your country gets settled and you go back home. The other is that some developed countries take you in through their humanitarian program.
Yep.
And the third is that the country you live in offers you citizenships and you become naturalized in that country. That option wasn't available. The third option wasn't available in Kenya. And the first option wasn't available because South Sudan was still in the midst of an ongoing civil war. And at that time, I think it was one of the longest running civil war on the continent of Africa. So the third option was to see whether there was a country willing to resettle us. And my mom applied and we got accepted in 2005 to resettle in Australia. And yeah, so
How did that come to pass? How did your mum decide that we're going to apply for? Was there a choice between Australia and other countries, or was it simply we just have to get out of here?
Yeah, it's both. Right. Yeah, you just have to get out of there, and whichever country was willing to take you, is what you're going to. I don't think if we got an offer to go to America, they would have said, no, we're waiting for Australia to give us an offer.
Yeah.
But we did. My mom at the time had a brother who lived in the United States, and he didn't think United States was a really good place to raise kids. And he told mom, you know, if you do get a country like Australia, perhaps consider going there. And he was really instrumental because it's part of the process. It's this two way. There were two ways at the time to come to Australia. One is to have the Australian government directly sponsored families come here, and the other is that you get sponsored by a family member or a relative who was already settled here.
Yeah.
And if your option was using the family members or who had settled in Australia, it was a very different process. You had to pay for your medical testing, because to come to Australia you have to go through thorough medical testing, and you had to pay for a couple of other stuff, the process itself. And my uncle in the United States paid for everything, and to pay for everybody who is, you know, 10 of us, it was really expensive, wow, including the tickets and everything. So we were very lucky that we had those little connections to help us. And then the family member who also sponsored us here to come.
That's amazing. Mm. So from the time that you learnt that you were coming to Australia to actually arriving in Australia, how long was that?
That's not the longer process, you know. The longer process is when you start the application.
Yep.
Then you have to wait for the interviews. Then you have to do the medical testing. Then you have to wait for the Australian government to decide whether or not you are deemed worthy to come here, or deemed desperate enough to come here. I mean, I don't know how they make these decisions. That took time. I think we started the application in the early 2000s, and it wasn't until 2005 that we came here. And I know now that the process is even harder to sponsor family members. So I think if someone was trying to bring my family and I now, we probably wouldn't have a chance. The process has really become harder, almost impossible.
What's the driving force behind it becoming harder?
I think the government migration policies have just become tougher and tougher.
Yeah.
And I think also that very negative narrative about refugee settlement is also contributed into it, being refusing entry. I think particularly people of African descent or people from Africa and some Asian countries find it harder to come to Australia. So, yeah, no, I'm not willing to go as far as saying there's an intentional discriminatory process in place, but there definitely seems to be a preference of not having people like me having an easier process of coming to this country and a more.
Okay.
Yeah, seems to be, it's, yeah, very hard. I mean, I have people that I would like to sponsor that I know would really could, but I, you know, the process now takes 16 or so years. It's so hard.
Oh.
Yeah, it's so hard now.
So do you think your family got in because of the desperation or because of what you could offer in the eyes of the government, or you have no idea what?
I just think we were lucky, to be honest. I think that we're lucky that things hadn't progressed. You know, 9/11 hadn't happened by then. You know, I think that the political atmosphere wasn't as toxic as it is today. And then I think that therefore then, at that time, it was just really about your story. You know, people could look at your story and say, does this family, you know, look like a family that have a genuine fear or, you know, have, an, you know, being there, have possible risk to their life and their livelihood. It wasn't the global narrative now, whether, you know, they don't integrate, look at how other will come to this country behave. You know, it wasn't that kind of broader judgment that I think now has filled this migration story. Mm. It was, I think at the time, as much as possible looking at those stories. That's my experience of it. But yeah, I think in some ways we're just lucky and that we were able to be judged by the story we presented.
Okay.
Yeah.
So once, can you talk our listeners through, because I think a lot of people think they know what happens during this process, but you get, obviously it's a long period application to acceptance.
Yes.
From acceptance to actually getting on a plane, what's that feeling like, firstly?
Mm.
And then when you land, how are you treated? What's the environment that you're walking into?
Yeah, I mean, so you start off with an application telling your whole story, and then you've got to take a number of tests. Then you've got to do an interview. Then you've got to do the medical testing. Then you wait for the approval. And for me, I just couldn't wait to get out. I was so desperate to get out of the camp. By the time we were we had finished our application. We'd almost begun to believe that it wasn't going to happen because we had not heard from the Australian government, I think, for a while. I think one of the difficulties why is because there is no postal address in a refugee camp that the government can just post you your letter so you can receive it. And so we had to go to the IOM office, which is, I think, International Organization of Migration or something. Don't quote me on it. But anyway, IOM, and then they tell you you've got approval. And the only way you could transfer information in Kakuma was to have these big boards where people's names were posted, or, you know, if you've got a letter with IAM, say, go pick up something from IAM or something like that. So I think that's what makes it harder. But then so that silence was very hard for me personally. I just wanted to know whether I was going to leave that camp. And I was in my last year of high school, and I knew that was pretty much the end of my education if I couldn't get out of that camp, because there was no way my mom was going to afford university studies in Kenya. And I used to pray all night. I mean, my mom, after a while, she was generally very religious, but at some point, because we were not hearing anything, she started asking us to like try and pray every night to see whether we can just hurry up God to get the Australian government to make up their mind. And we would sing, you know, my mom, she would sing gospel songs and pray, and then everyone goes to bed. And then after that, I would just lie on my back and start negotiating with an imaginary God in my head. Just like, get me out of this camp, and I'm going to be a very good Christian. I always listen to mom, and I'm never going to complain. And I did all these trades, you know, as a desperate teenager wanting to pursue further studies and a different life. And I was lucky enough that that actually happened, and that we did come in 2005 in March, landed at Tullamarine Airport. And I remember thinking like the world has literally flipped upside down, because you looked up and could not see any stars, but you looked down and it was this map of twinkles across the floor. It's like all these lights, and Kakuma has no running electricity. So, it was a sight. And our first memory of Melbourne was going through the Melbourne tunnels, and someone saying, you know, there are buildings or something on top of this tunnel. And I thought that was really amazing. There's sometimes when I drive through that tunnel that I still remember that moment, especially as the lights flip through as you go through. Yeah. Remember, it's like a movie scroll at the end. But anyway, I get distracted. But that was my first memory. Yeah.
Great memory.
Yeah.
What were you feeling at the time? Like, was it, I can't imagine, like the fear, intrepidation, excitement, hope, all of the above.
I don't recall any fear at all. I think I was so excited I could almost just leap out of my skin. I was so excited just to see what this new world had to offer. And I had really big dreams and big goals that I wanted to achieve. I knew that I was going to take every single opportunity that came my way and was going to try to get the best out of it. I was ready to go, you know. I think had you taken me to school the next day and enrolled me, I was ready to start. Yeah, I was ready to go.
So let's talk about school.
Mm.
So what year did you walk into? Did you walk into VCE or year 11?
Yes, I went into year 11. In Kenya, I was at the beginning of the equivalent of year 12.
Yep.
But I thought I needed time to understand how the system worked here. I needed time to get used to the system. So I enrolled at year 11 instead of going straight to year 12. And I also assumed that I wouldn't be allowed to enroll in year 12. So I went back to year 11, did half of year 11, and then went straight to year 12 and did the VCE.
Yeah.
Mm.
How did you find Australian school in comparison to...
There was definitely a different of attitudes. I think The approach in Kenya is very structured. So the teachers were definitely the leaders. You had such respect for your elders and your teachers. You didn't speak until you were spoken to. You raise your hand if you needed to say something. Quite different. I went, you know, like students felt like they could speak back to the teachers. It was really shocking to me because you just could never speak back to a teacher in Kenya. You couldn't even speak back to your parents. So, yeah, so that was really interesting to watch. I also felt that there was definitely an expectation of us that because we came from a refugee camp, there were just certain things we couldn't do. Like, I think there was a lower expectations of us, or maybe the other term is manage expectations of us. And I found those really confining. I did try to push back, but eventually I just gave up and just let it be. I think that was quite an interesting contrast too, because, I mean, in high school in Kakuma, you know, this is a refugee camp, but the teachers there, they never made us feel like refugees. They were telling us, you can be whatever you work hard enough to be. And to come to a country like Australia and to go to a school and to almost find the opposite, you know, that...
Yeah.
You know, maybe lower your expectations. You can't do this subject. You've just been here for less than 7 years. You know, like, there was all these things that there was already like a space created for people like you. And it was this that you had to fit into. And I felt as though it never took into account our different variables as individuals. You know, just because we all came from refugee camps. Some of us came from English speaking countries and others came from Arab speaking countries. It didn't mean that we couldn't do certain subjects. And so that was an interesting experience. And it left me with a sense of, which I sort of let happen, that all you just had to do was get by. Mm. You know, you didn't really have to push for excellence because, you know, you weren't necessarily expected to arise above a certain mark.
Yeah. Mm. So you arrived, you said to yourself, I'm ready. Let's go. You walk into the system and you're greeted with this point of view that, you know, hey, you know, you just getting by is okay.
Mm-hmm.
When did you decide to continue to, you know, say, hey, let's go?
It was... I should mention that it wasn't all the teachers, definitely. I had some really good teachers in the school I went to. One in particular, Miss Ma, who just, she thought, I remember asking, I said, Miss Ma, do you think I could do law? She said, yeah, you can. And by that time, I believed like, my English was so terrible that I probably couldn't get into law. But I think maybe I'd always let the light
still there.
Somewhere had the light still somewhere, and it was re-sparked again by conversations that I had with people after I had finished my undergraduate degree. Well, I think one in particular was driving back from Shepparton after a community event with a lady called Maria Demopolis, and she said, you know, you could actually do law. You think quite strategically and analytically. Maybe you should think about doing law.
Mm.
And then I applied. I applied to Melbourne Law School, and I had applied knowing that I wouldn't get in. So the plan was I was going to go to South Sudan, because by the time I'd finished my undergraduate degree and I was applying to get to Melbourne to do law, South Sudan was actually becoming independent. So this whole fight that had displaced my family and I was now being actualized, and there was a referendum happening in South Sudan, which was a vote for the people of South Sudan to decide whether they wanted to be an independent state. And so I went to participate in that process.
Right.
So as I was leaving, I submitted my application to Melbourne. I said, no way I'm going to get in, but give it a try. So I went to South Sudan, and my sister called me saying I got in.
Why did you think there's no way you get in?
I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I was good enough. I thought, you know, Melbourne Law School only take people that are so excellent and so smart, and there is no way that I was close to that mark.
Yeah.
But, and I can't remember why I still applied then. But I did, and I remember getting a call from my sister when she received the letter, and I was so excited. I was in Nairobi at the time, staying at my uncle's house, and I started jumping, just literally jumping. And I had to go outside because I was afraid I was going to hit my head on something and inside the house. Yep. And I continued jumping outside. I remember people looking at me through windows thinking she must be crazy. Yeah. And I didn't care. Yeah. I was so excited. Although I stopped to ask my sister whether she was sure, because I think she had read a letter once and conveyed the wrong message, the opposite of it. Right. So for some reason, I just thought, she didn't read it well. They rejected me, and somehow she just saw Melbourne Uni and thought I got in. Yeah. And I had to confirm like 3-4 times. Are you sure? Are you sure? And she's like, yes, I'm sure. I'm going to send you a copy of it. Yes, it was such exciting news to come back to. And Melbourne Law School, to me, I think the greatest thing it did for me was it absolutely shattered that, maybe for lack of a better word, like that mediocre standard I had come to not embrace, but thought there was no need to challenge, because I was surrounded by people who just expected excellence of themselves. You know, just they didn't expect to fail. They expect just to get good marks. And it was kind of a radical thing to meet people who thought, you know, being good or being excellent or being good at something wasn't an accident that occurred once in a while. It was something you did all the time. You just expected it. And that was a big shift. And the way to explain it maybe to the listeners is the group of people who grow up in environments where they don't get to hear conversations about, you know, you can be the leaders of tomorrow. And the prime minister went to this school. And, you know, the high court judge was a former student from this school. And then there are kids who grow up exactly with that messaging, you know, that you work hard enough, there's a path for you that is above the board. And I think that creates very different mentalities, very different attitudes towards life, and very different sense of directing your energies. And I think I lived in both worlds, and I think Melbourne Law School shift that perspective. Now, I don't think that is necessarily the right, I don't think necessarily is the right attitude to have through your life. And I hope that I've learned enough so far and will continue to learn to better use that, because I think the most arrogant thing as well, I think that attitude as well, that attitude of growing up in environments where you think you are by virtue of your intelligence or your hard work entitled to certain things can create a sense of arrogance that doesn't allow you the necessary humility to understand that you're just another human being in a 7 billion world. So I think so it's been learning both, but I think you need that kind of spark to think, I can expect the best out of myself.
Yeah.
I just don't have to get by. Yeah. I just don't have to get 50s. You know, I can aim higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier, and I asked you a question about resilience and growing up in a refugee camp and the situation that you endured, that, you know, and I suggested perhaps it gave you more resilience, and you said perhaps it's the other way around, that because you weren't surrounded with stability, that it's actually harder.
I think I remember someone saying, I don't think they meant it right. They meant bad, actually. I think I was talking to them about my experiences of childhood and refugee camps, and they said, you know, but those were character buildings, you know, in some ways. And I remember thinking, you know what, I actually do not want character building events in my life. I just want to have a nice walk in the park. I am not interested in character building anything at all. There is truth that I think when we go through hard experiences that we are resilient as a result. I resist it though, because I don't think we need it. I don't think there's one single child who have experienced childhood trauma that think there is a positive spin to that.
Yeah.
If anything, I think it creates these hurdles in life that you have to overcome to wrestle meaning out of your own life. You know, because I didn't grow up with a sense of stability and love and assurance. I also didn't grow up with a sense of worth, you know, and a sense of worthlessness is one of the worst ways you can live your life. And so I've had to create worth. But I've had to create worth by intentionally owning that I didn't know what concept of worth was. You know, I also didn't feel as if I grew up with sufficient understanding of what love meant, you know. And so I've had to also try and find ways of having that in my life. And so I think traumatic childhood experiences can leave people broken in ways that they can't put themselves together, you know. And I think that if you do survive, and you do get out and you make something out of your life, that is never a story of how bad it wasn't. It's not a story that it wasn't that bad. You know, it's a story that you survived despite it. And it's a story to other people that they can survive, but also that if they don't, or however they manage to survive, it's understandable, you know. It's understandable. So I think it gives me the way I explain it sometimes, that I have walked past, I'm not suggesting that people who are homeless necessarily have traumatic child, but I've walked past people who are homeless or of someone who looks as if they are in distress, psychological somewhere, and thought, the line between me and them isn't that big. I've just been lucky that in some ways I think I've had right mentors at the right time. I've had things also that I don't think that I necessarily can take account for. Maybe I was just somehow resilient. How are we born more resilient than others? I don't know. Maybe it's just a disposition, you know. And I hope that it's not saying that people can't survive that. I just don't want, you know, survival bias to be the story. And I also hope that. You know, people who have gone through trauma or real pain or real loss, that understand that pain will always live with you, and you can't create a denial attitude around it, which retells it in a way that is not true. Like, it's pain, it's lost, but it's also not your entire story, and you can, whenever possible, rebuild and continue to rebuild yourself. So I feel like part of what I'm doing and what I'm always going to do is a sense of growing up and self-raising in a way, raising oneself and always growing up and always trying to improve and always learning and changing and being open to being better in a way that constantly denies my path of its power to influence where I go.
Thank you for sharing that. That is amazing. When you think about creating worth and you creating worth of yourself, how do you do that?
Yeah, it's a lot of uncomfortable conversations with yourself. very, very, very uncomfortable. But a lot of it, I think, comes from, I don't think you can do it without taking the time out to really spend time with who you are and to really see where some of your faults come from. So if one thing I noticed, for example, was that it was very easy for me to be triggered by what other people said. And most of the time there was something that they'd said that was wrong. But I had to ask myself, why am I so bothered, you know, by this person that I had never met, probably will never meet? Why am I so bothered by what they said? And I realized that there was work that I needed to do internally. You know, it wasn't so much what they say. It was the sort of wounds that were still open that I had not recognized. And so I had effectively been able to find a space for a lot of my early traumatic experiences, I think. And I don't think this is something I did consciously. I think survival mode kick in at some point, find a place for these things and close them off. And so when I came to Australia, for example, I just like started sprinting. I kept just went to school, went to uni, did a JD, got admitted into legal profession, became a lawyer. So just I just sprint
yeah.
through those years. I didn't stop. I didn't reflect much. You know, I'd always been a reader, so I'd read. That was pretty much a lot of where my reflective self was contained. And then I had my kids, and then that whole childhood memory started coming up again. And I remember, for example, dropping my daughter at a childcare and having a panic attack because I thought someone was going to hurt my kid. Mm-hmm. I was so scared. I vomited into my mouth and was running around Melbourne Central looking for a bin to like chuck my vomiter. And I had to calm myself down and tell myself there's nothing wrong happening right now. But yeah. that for me was a clear sign that, okay, now you need to actually look into this. This you can escape it. And I wanted to be a good mom to my kids. So the first thing I did, I wanted to talk to somebody. So I think there is a lot of, I mean, I had constructed my whole identity around being strong. You know, I'm going to survive this no matter what. And so for me to be vulnerable and I say, I need to talk to somebody about this.
Yeah.
Like that was an admission that I cannot entirely rely on myself. And that to me was a big admission because part of, I think, surviving everything that happened in childhood was to try and be self-contained, to get everything you can from yourself and not ask for help from anybody else because you had nobody in a way. So opening myself and saying, okay, I can't deal with this by myself. I need to see someone was one. But in some ways, it was hard for me, but I had been able to have those honest conversations earlier on, but in ways that were not that sensitive. So when I went to started my job, I recognized that I spoke English well, I think well enough, but my written English wasn't up to where I wanted it to be. So despite doing law at Melbourne Law School and being, you know, accepted to work at a commercial law firm, I had to go back and learn the basic of English. And that was a step down from my ego. You need to learn basic English here. So I went back and did that. So I'd done it in sort of, I recognized where I was failing. So this honest, just having a honest take of who you are. And I think that's a harder thing to do when you're already internally really vulnerable because you are afraid that you're going to discover a lot of things about who you are that you don't like or that you need to work on.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so I think that's the one way to heal yourself is to recognize where your wounds are.
Mm.
And one of the ways you do get to know where your wounds are is how other people make you feel and how much power other people have over your sense of self and your sense of worth. And I think that exposes some of the places you need to do some work on.
Mm.
And so I've been... It's taken time and I think it's taken growth both in just getting older and not being, you know, a teenage sort of being a teenager and thinking you're all that. I think it's getting old, having children, having more responsibilities, but also a sense, I think, you know, of being exhausted with the way things are, you know, of I had never necessarily felt a tremendous debilitating sense of bitterness toward things other people had done. But I felt like I'd always had this gentle no self-talk about it, you know, that it was just constantly there and wanting to elevate your life to something different so that you can begin to really have significant joy, like real joy, like the joy that you laugh and you know that you're laughing from somewhere that is full of life.
Yeah.
You know, that involves a very different level of growth and conversations with yourself. But you can, I think you can get there. And I don't think it's a destination, actually. I should correct myself. I think it's constant growth towards that.
Joy in just being who you are rather than doing this and climbing the ladder and producing stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because that's sort of also what you discover is that survival in... So I think, you know, I had to understand that the way I had also survived was useful for getting through some of the things, but it wasn't entirely healthy. You know, like achievement.
Sprinting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, it wasn't. And you know, so that to me, like, it was that was also a form of hiding from something else. You know, like, it was a form of not dealing with the basic fundamental questions of life that I think all of us have. And that's what I think exists. I think those questions are complicated, or their answers are complicated by trauma and loss. But I think all of us human beings have those basic questions about self-worth. Who am I? What do I want to do with my life? Am I a good person? You know, hopefully we do, or we're some sort of weird sociopaths in some ways, I think. But I think all of us have those experience of wanting to have a life that is meaningful. So I think it was accepting that meaning didn't have to be derived, at least for me, from outward achievements, that a part of deriving meaning was internal work. And that's a much more recent discovery for me, that the lockdown had a big part of slowing me down enough to hear that inner voice say, you know, it's time to slow down. You're not in a refugee camp. Yeah. You've got food in the fridge. Your kids are safe. You know, just slow down. It's okay. It's fine. Yeah.
That'd have to be one of the best realizations ever, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was scared of it. You know, I'd scared because I business was good. I mean, you did stuff. You had stuff to do. You had stuff to go on to. And I didn't know how I was going to feel with a life that didn't feel busy. I didn't know what I was going to feel it with. Mm. And I didn't know whether I was going to enjoy it at all. Mm. But I had started this exercise before the pandemic, where I had told myself that I was going to start listening to my intuition more. Because I felt I was spending a lot of time being analytical and overthinking stuff. So I started telling myself, this is going to sound so silly. So I stopped eating whenever I felt full, the first moment I felt full. Like, I was just starting to get in touch with my intuition in a way that, you know, didn't involve questioning it. I also was the kind of person that say, if I go exercise, I'll push myself so hard. I stop the moment my body said stop, because I knew I could do the other thing. I knew I could push myself four times harder if I wanted to. Yeah. I wanted to try what, you know, like stopping when my body say, this is enough. So I started doing those things, and then gradually, I think, and what I was trying to do was do this little thing enough until I can begin to hear my inner voice again as clearly as possible. And yeah, so I felt after the lockdown, what happened when the lockdown happened, I did have a lot of things going on, and then everything was shut down, especially the second lockdown, and everything was postponed. And I was spending a lot of time at home with my kids, and we'd wake up in the morning and I'll go for these long walks, you know, and then before I came and work, and they became really reflective time. So I had all this quiet time, and that quiet time, I started, you know, thinking that my intuition was telling me that I needed to stop. I needed silence and quiet. And that's what I've been trying to do. Like, I'm reading more now. I am walking more. I am saying no to a lot of things that I would have said yes to without a second thought.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's a privilege and a pleasure that you get, because in some ways you live in a country like Australia, you know, because I think all of the other attitudes and behaviors that I had developed because things were, you know, was scarce. You had to survive, and now I don't have to live in that way all the time. Mm. You know, I won't starve because I didn't work an extra day, sort of thing. Yeah.
You don't need to answer this question if you don't feel like it, but you mentioned earlier that you needed to work out what love meant for you, and have you worked that out?
No. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm thinking about, no, I don't think I've necessarily worked that out. Because I think I'm working it out.
Yeah.
I'm definitely working it out. Because I don't think I grew up with a sense of love. And I remember, like, I mean, this is how much I didn't have a concept of it. I remember when people, I watched TV and those award shows, someone wake up and say, oh, I thank the love of my family and all these things. And I used to think it was just something people did because it was polite. You know, I didn't think it's because it was real, you know. It's so weird. But I'd also not grown up with my siblings, but and now that they're in my life and I see the, you know, the connection they have with my family and, you know, the lockdown missing them, I now know what love feels like. It's like, you know, that deep sense of being connected to someone, wholeness, and you want the best for them and you want them to be healthy and you don't have to be by yourself all the time, you know. So my family has really taught me that. My children have taught me that, you know, I would die for my kids.
Yeah.
So yeah. That, you know, and so that's been good. That's been really, really good. I think the thing is, even though growing up, I didn't feel like I was surrounded by love or knew what it was, I was always a loyal person. So I knew that I would be loyal to the people that I trusted or liked or something. So that to me, I think I confused loyalty with love for a while.
Yeah.
And so it's been good to develop all these things and to grow in them. I also think love is really defined by the time. I mean, for me, it's also defined by just the growth of, I feel like I've been growing a lot, which is a strange thing for a 33-year-old to be saying. I think I've been, been doing a lot of growth.
You ever stop learning, do you?
Yeah.
You shouldn't stop learning.
No, you don't, I think you're right. You never stop growing. I'd like to grow, but I think I actually measured myself the other day. I'm shrinking. old age.
Different type of growth too.
It is. Yeah. It is. I'm going to change tact a little bit.
Okay.
And I'm conscious of time. We're running out of it fast. So you talked about community advocacy up front and you didn't want to call it that or put that badge on it, but you have and are, you express your views and opinions publicly. Firstly, how did that part of the work that you do arise? How did that first come to fruition?
So I think part of the reason I'm uncomfortable with the title community advocate is because it implies a number of things that I'm not sure are accurate. First of all, what community and how can I speak for a community?
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible. I can only speak truly for myself. The other is I don't think that's something you ever earn as a title, you know. I feel comfortable with a lawyer because I went to school and I got admitted and I practiced. You know, there's things building up to it. Whereas here, I feel as a citizen who expressed opinion about things they didn't feel comfortable about. So, and that came about because at the time there was a lot of negative and, in my view, highly racist and racialized conversations about African gangs. You know, and if anyone thinks that's a very strong statement to make, I want people to reflect on this. Suppose a 16-year-old white boy goes to a pharmacy and robs a pharmacist. I'm not sure any white person tomorrow is going to wake up feeling guilty about it if they're not connected with it. You know, they're going to go to their work, they're going to mind their business. It doesn't say anything about any other person because a white kid did this.
Yep.
And I think that's what should happen when it's a black kid who does the same thing. I shouldn't have to feel responsible or be told to answer for a black kid that I don't know committing a crime because we are connected by skin color.
Yeah.
And that's the only connection we have. And I felt as if our whole community was being asked to respond to that. Not the majority of us that weren't committing crimes. Not only that, but to somehow prove that we were not capable of doing the same thing, you know. And it's very hard to prove a negative, you know. The only way I can prove a negative is continue to live my life the way I'm living it. And so I felt that was the racialized aspect of it, that the reason we're being asked as a community to condemn this behavior or to speak against this is because we are connected by skin color. And I started pushing back against that narrative toward media appearances and writing articles and pushing back and saying this is harmful. First of all, it's harmful to the majority of people who just are taxpaying citizens and just want to live their life. And it's not accurate as a story. This is not the story of Sudanese Australian or African Australian settlement. And it's racist.
You have been, I don't know how to describe it, but the way that you've been treated for your speaking out about the wrongs and the untruths, it's I can't imagine what it's been like. I think you've even had to cancel your Twitter account due to trolling. How do you cope with that when all you're trying to do is right some wrongs and educate and you get what you got?
I'm not surprised.
You're not?
No. I wasn't surprised because even before I started speaking up, that was part of my world. I had been called a nigger twice just walking down a street. I had not done anything to these people. Just walking down a street on a nice, beautiful day like this. Mm. Someone just feels the need to call you a nigger. I've experienced there. I've had conversations with my nieces about people calling them Vegemites and, you know, because of their skin color. I've had conversations with my own brother about the experiences of discrimination they've got or people talking about them. I've had conversations with I remember actually one incident, my mom coming from shopping and just, you know, she put the shopping around and I don't know what we're talking about. And she said, oh, someone just called me a black dog. And the way she said it, you know, it was as if someone had said, isn't it a beautiful sunny day? Like it was just like she had come to accept, like people can say that. Mm. So in a way, I wasn't surprised by that backlash because I think people have a very different, have this idea of what they think Australia is. And that comes from their own experiences of what Australia is. And when you try to tell them that it's different for other people, they feel attacked. They feel the idea of Australia, the Anglo-Italian idea of Australia, the free and freedom and giving country is under attack. And they switch it really quickly on you so that you are the ungrateful one. Like, why are you complaining? We took you from a refugee camp and I'm using hair quote here, gave you all these things. You know, you didn't work for them. We gave them to you. Mm. And you realize, and to me, I think in an interesting way, I think that comes from their own sense of fear, you know, on holding on to ideas about who they think they are and who they think their country is. So it wasn't surprising. It was intense enough to make me want to leave Twitter once in a while and definitely was part of the contributing factor onto why I have left Twitter entirely.
Yeah.
Because there was no one time I wrote an article or I went on television where I wasn't racially abused afterward.
Not once.
You know. And when I said racially abused, this is not one comment. It was multiple comments. You know, one of them was going on Q&A and having one of these people make a video about me using the story of somebody in my family was going through a tough time and had done something wrong and being trolled by nearly 250,000 of his followers and having to delete all pictures of my children on social media. I now don't do anything. So that was quite a coordinated online attack. And so, you know, and then you've got people in mainstream media who do it in their own way, you know, who write articles about you, who sort of just push you enough so that the extremes won't pick it up and come and say all the nasty stuff they want to say. It's a toxic space to be there. And I always often wonder if a young black woman, brown woman wanted to do the same, whether I would encourage them to do so. Because I am not sure whether it's worth it. Because in addition to the racist online abuse and the toil and energy that takes away from you, it also is a very it's not paid work, you know, most of the time. You also have to do your work. And and it takes time from your work. And so there are also other consequences to that.
Yeah.
So I will always wonder whether, I probably would, because I think we need more voices in this space, because we can't have a national conversation about who we are or who we can be that doesn't reflect all of our experiences.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's that would be a very incomplete image of what modern Australia should be.
And we were talking earlier about, like, it all looks so hard for it doing what you do. Like, you need to work hard to shape a really articulate and educated point of view and conversation. You then need to work hard to deliver that in a way where it gets cut through to a culture and a society that not necessarily wants to listen to what you have to say. Then you need to work hard to either ignore or deal with the shit that comes your way.
Yep.
And you do that again and again and again. Like,
or then you have to turn up the next day and be as normal as you can at work and pretend that you just didn't have someone say they want to call you or kill you or any other form of it. Or somehow, you know, after that session, walk home, put a smile on your face, give your kids a bath, read them a book and put them to bed. Like, yeah. And I think that's the world that you have to occupy if you are not in the mainstream, when society is not built with you as the default setting. You know, you will have to balance all these worlds, you know, the mainstream, the Sudanese. And that's not to say that even in my own communities, I'm a model of what is acceptable. You know, I'm a feminist and that pisses off a lot of Sudanese conservative men, you know, in my own community. And that comes with its own backlash, you know. So it was a hard balance. But my attitude towards getting through that is, I think that's when denial is a good thing, actually. I think when you're going through a lot of things, denial is a good thing, just to postpone things until when you can actually reflect how hard they are. So normally I play tricks with myself mentally and I tell myself, we're not even going to think this is going to be hard. We're just going to do it. Because thinking that is hard is extra commentary that you do not need right now. And it's because if you begin to think how hard it is, you won't want to do it, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. So, so that's what I did. I just told myself it needs to be done and I did it. And I just stayed up really late at night. I did my own research. I prepared for those interviews. And then sometimes stay up late, delete all the abusive messages, try really hard, really, really hard not to respond to any of the comments. Sometimes I failed and I did. And then try and do something else in my life that took me away from it, whether go and meet my friends, do something fun with them, go out to the park with my kids. Sometimes I intentionally do is this, for example, if I go to an interview and it was a full-on interview, I'll get home, I'll park my car, I'll leave my phone in the car, and I'll go into the house for 2 to 3 hours and just leave my phone alone.
Yeah.
So just having those levers in place that sort of release the pressures here and there is a good thing. And then stopping. I think rest is a big part of it, knowing when to stop when you've pushed enough. I wasn't very good at doing that generally in my life. And one of the things now I tell myself is I'm allowed 3 shots at something. So if I'm finding it very hard, I'll push once, I'll push again. The third time I have to stop. I'm not allowed to. Yeah, to do anymore after the third thing. Because I know if I don't put marks in, but I just keep doing it.
Keep going.
And the thing is, we all get exhausted at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe there are people who are wonderful there that don't get exhausted. But and I don't want it to creep on me that I'm exhausted. I want to be able to take the break before I really need a break. Because I think by the time you really need a break, you probably should have taken one like 4 months ago or something. Ago. Yeah.
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 Two more questions. You're starting a new chapter. You're starting a new role.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that particular role.
I can't.
Okay.
I can't, partly because I just think it's going to invite unnecessary commentary. I mean, it's not a private thing. If someone Google it, they'll find it. But yeah, I'm just taking a role that it's gonna feel like a different pace to life. I think it's gonna be still as challenging, but I don't think it's gonna allow me more time with my kids, which I really want to. And one of the phase that I'm really trying to cultivate right now in my life is create more time for reading and writing. An extended period of reflection and inward and like, yeah, an extended period of reflection and concentration on my inner life.
Very cool.
Yeah. I want to consciously do that, you know. I don't know. I've always felt like who are these we I'm talking about? But let me say that I have a plan, or I've always had some sort of a plan about where I want to go in my life. I don't know whether they'll be true. Like, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be that. And maybe perhaps I think that we build a plan towards how to approach our outer life, but I don't think we reflectively do the same thing for our inner life. Like, have a plan about how I'm going to approach my inner life. And I'm trying to do that. My inner life is like, I'm going to take time to, yeah, it sounds very fancy, but hey, you know, living in a first world country, I'm happy to have that first world problem. I always feel that I have no more, I don't want to jump out of planes. I'm not looking for excitement. I just want to walk in the park, you know, just want to enjoy life in its slow bits. And that's an opportunity that I do have to get now, because I live in a relatively safe and stable country. I can take the time to do that, and hopefully that's what I'm going to do.
Well, I reckon that's a great place to wrap this up. Hey, look, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It has been absolutely amazing. And if we could wish anything for you, we'd just say, hey, we really hope that you enjoy that walk in the park.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been interesting.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
What an amazing human. What an amazing woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you take away from that?
Well, probably that you can't sprint all the time, and that you, despite the trauma that she experienced in her childhood and continues to experience when she speaks up for a community that she may or may not feel like she represents, that she can actually take a step back from that and go, actually, checklists, to-do lists, you don't have to do it all. All she wants to enjoy is the slow things in life, the small things, a simple walk in the park and enjoying time with her kids.
Yeah. Wasn't it amazing that here's a woman that, born in a refugee camp, has basically needed to focus on survival for all of her life, that it's taken a pandemic for her to take the foot off the accelerator and get less busy, for her to actually have that discovery that ticking off the to-do list and making things happen all the time and surviving isn't the big answer.
Yeah.
The big answer is finding her true self and finding happiness in not what she does, but who she is.
Yeah.
A couple of other things that I took away, like just she said that, you know, pain and loss is not just her whole story, and she didn't want her story just to be, or her life, in fact, to be focused on that. And like, she had a plan to focus on, you know, coming to Australia or getting a VCE or, you know, making it through Melbourne Uni or becoming a lawyer, she's now got a plan to focus on her inner self and her growth. And I reckon that's a fantastic thing. I wonder, you know, we walked into this new year and I wonder how many people out there have actually got a plan to focus on who they are, not just what they do.
Yeah, it's a good point. The other thing I noticed about her is, and this is something where people really have to work hard on, is she was completely authentic with us. What she spoke was absolutely from the heart.
Yeah.
And I know that our listeners can't see Nidal when we're actually doing this recording, or you can probably hear in her voice, but she was very emotional still. This is a story that she's told numerous times, especially of her time in a refugee camp, yet every single time it looks like it still hits home very hard, which is not surprising at all.
Yeah.
And something she said to us off air at the end was, you know, she struggles to not be authentic. And she certainly gave everything to us today, which is amazing.
Yeah, was amazing. Last one for me. She talked about self-worth.
Yep.
And, you know, just that realization and thinking about, you know, how do other people's opinions about you make you feel, and what sort of power do others have over you and your sense of self and self-worth? And given what she does, you know, she's put herself out there and it's really clear that she gets this bombardment of mostly negativity.
Yep.
And she's working hard on not taking that on board and not attributing that crap to her self-worth.
Certainly something that is new to the last 10, 15 years. Mm. And I think in the past, many individuals, apart from those in positions of real celebrity or power, had to deal with. And now someone who is effectively just standing up for people in and around her community, and that's not just of African descent, of any sort of community, you have to deal with that sort of crap.
Yeah.
And it's new and nobody really knows how to deal with it, but she's doing clearly an amazing job.
Yeah. Well, I reckon a cracking episode and a cracking story and an amazing humour to kick us off and launch us off early in 2021 and for us to be reminded of what's important, that it's not just about what you do, but it's about your value to yourself and your self-worth, and to enjoy the little things like having a little walk in the park.
Walk in the park, that's right. Yeah.
Nick, time for us to go and walk in the park.
I'll see you down there, Blake.
See you, mate.